Welcome to our Gold to podcast, where we take you behind the scenes with authors of many different writing styles. I'm Lucinda Hawksley, and today we're delving into history writing. I do hope you enjoy this episode. If you want to find out more, go to www.goldster.co.uk and don't forget to subscribe to the podcast. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Goldster Conversation. I'm very happy today to welcome Francesca Wade, who is the author of this gorgeous book called Square Haunting. I don't know if you can see that, if I can hold this correctly. You can't. Five Women, Freedom and London Between the Wars. If I put it right in front of my face, you can see it there. So, Francesca, welcome to Goldster. It's so good to see you here. Now, I last saw you at the Avon Foundation. This is when I discovered about your book. So for those of you who aren't aware, Avon is an organization where writers teach writing, and we always have a guest speaker to come in, and Francesca came to speak about Square Haunting, and I thought it was so fabulous that I knew I had to get her onto Goldster. So thank you for joining us at a very ungodly time of the morning for you. Do you want to tell everybody where you're
Yes, it's slightly dark outside. I'm in Boston, Massachusetts, where it's a bit earlier than it is for you, but it's very nice to be here.
Well, I'm very, very glad you managed to set your alarm and get up on time. Do you want to ease in gently? Would you like to do a reading from Square Haunting?
Yeah, I'd love to. I thought I would read a bit from the beginning, really. Not quite the very beginning, but at the beginning of the first, the sort of introduction. Which will give an impression of the book and the place where it's set, which is really one of the characters of the book, and to the five women whose stories the book tells, and as well as to some of the themes.
Fantastic, thank you.
Marooned on an island in the middle of a busy junction, a stone woman stoops to fill an urn with water. The drinking fountain on which she kneels has long since run dry. The steps leading down to the public lavatories behind her are boarded up. The elegant parade of Georgian buildings to her right is severed by a busy construction site. She breathes the fumes of cars passing down Guildford Street, which connects Bloomsbury with Clerkenwell and London's East, while workmen perch on her pedestal to eat their sandwiches. She is a remnant of the past, frozen in the present, her name and story buried like the Fleet River on whose banks Guildford Street was built. Cities are composed of roads and buildings, but also of myths and memories, stories which bring the brick and asphalt to life and bind the present to the past. For Virginia Woolf, this unassuming statue just outside the entrance to Mecklenburg Square, the woman of Samaria, commissioned by a group of sisters in memory of their mother and designed by Henry Derbyshire in 1870, was one of the few pieces of sculpture in the streets of London that is pleasing to the eye. In a city decorated liberally with images of hoary statesmen in celebration of their service to empire, Woolf was intrigued by this anonymous woman who seemed to represent an alternative hidden history. I would venture to guess that Anon, who wrote so many poems without signing them, was often a woman, Woolf wrote in A Room of One's Own. In that book, she describes wandering the streets of London and observing women talking, walking, shopping, and selling. Their everyday animation reminds her of the accumulation of unrecorded life, which historians, in their habitual focus on the lives of great men, were yet to chronicle. For Woolf, the statue paid subversive tribute to the forgotten women of London's past, a small but significant reminder of the figures who have been left out of books, or whose talents were never allowed to reach their full potential, simply because they were women. In May 1917, T.S. Eliot described for his mother a visit to the American poet Hilda Doolittle, his new colleague on the Egoist magazine. "London is an amazing place," he wrote. "One is constantly discovering new quarters. This woman lives in a most beautiful, dilapidated old square which I had never heard of before, a square in the middle of town, near King's Cross Station, but with spacious old gardens about it." Somehow, Mecklenburg Square has remained a quiet enclave out on Bloomsbury's easternmost edge, separated from the better-known garden squares by Coram's Fields and the brutalist ziggurat of the Brunswick Centre. It is bounded by a graveyard, St. George's Gardens, and the noisy Gray's Inn Road, while its central garden, unusually for Bloomsbury, remains locked to non-residents and hidden behind high hedges. But for D.H. Lawrence, a one-time lodger there, Mecklenburg Square was the dark, bristling heart of London. At the turn of the 20th century, Mecklenburg Square was a radical address, and during the febrile years which encompassed the two world wars, it was home to the five women writers whose stories form this book. Virginia Woolf arrived with her bags and boxes at a moment of political chaos. She deliberated in her diaries how to go on through war, unaware that another writer had asked exactly that question in the same place 23 years earlier as Zeppelin raids toppled the books from her shelf. Hilda Doolittle, known as H.D., lived at 44 Mecklenburg Square during the First World War and hosted Lawrence and his wife Frieda while her husband Richard Aldington was fighting in France. In 1921, 3 years after H.D. had left the square abruptly for a new start in Cornwall, Dorothy L. Sayers created Lord Peter Wimsey, the swaggering hero of her first detective novel, in the very same room where H.D. had begun work on the autobiographical novel cycle that would occupy her for the rest of her life. From 1926 to 1928, Jane Ellen Harrison, the pioneer of classical and anthropological studies, supported a Russian-language literary magazine from the square, working among a diverse milieu of diaspora intellectuals. And at number 20, between 1922 and 1940, the historian Eileen Power convened socialist meetings to chart an anti-fascist future, scripted pacifist broadcasts for the BBC, and hosted raucous parties in her kitchen. These women were not a Bloomsbury group. They lived in Mecklenburg Square at separate times, though one or two knew each other and others were connected through shared interests, friends, even lovers. H.D. and Sayers lived in the square when their careers had hardly begun, Woolf and Harrison at the very ends of their lives. Power lived there for almost two decades, Sayers and Woolf just 1 year each. But for all of them, in different ways, their time in the square was formative. They all agreed that the structures which had long kept women subordinate were illusory and mutable. In their writing and in their lifestyles, they wanted to break boundaries and forge new narratives for women. In Mecklenburg Square, each dedicated herself to establishing a way of life that would let her fulfill her potential, to finding relationships that would support her work, and a domestic setup that would enable it. But it was not always easy. Their lives in the square demonstrate the challenges, personal and professional, that met, and continue to meet, women who want to make their voices heard.
Beautiful, thank you. That really does sum up, as you say, what is in this book. And it's a gorgeous book. I really just wondered, what was it that drew you to this? Where is Mecklenburg Square exactly? I mean, you described it in that, but for you, where is it? Why did you come across it? And what was it that made you want to write this?
Well, I mean, I started the book probably in 2015. I was relatively recently out of university and I was working at Persephone Books, which some of you may know, which at that point was...
Nicola Bowman, who founded Persephone Books on... Well, she's a wonderful woman. It was a lovely book on Lamb's Conduit Street.
Yes, and focusing on reprints covered in very beautiful grey paperbacks, mostly of 20th century women writers whose work was out of print. And while I was working there, I guess I had already studied a bit of HD at university. I did classics and I did a paper about the reception of Greek literature and sort of modern poetry, and got very interested in HD in her interpretations of the classics. She spent a lot of the First World War translating Greek tragedy into imagist style poetry, which was a real reflection, I think, on her state of mind during the war. And she did a lot of very interesting kind of reinterpretations of Greek myths, kind of refocusing attention on the women, on Helen of Troy. She wrote an amazing epic called Helen in Egypt, which imagines that Helen is not, you know, the sort of silent abducted muse who all of the warriors are fighting over, but actually is a sort of fractured woman's kind of seeking psychoanalysis to try and build her own identity that's been totally lost in all of these myths and sort of rumors and slander that are going around about her. So I was really interested in HD and knew that she had lived in Mecklenburg Square during the war when she was writing a lot of this poetry and translation. And so while I was working so close by, I started to explore the area a bit and realized that although I'd always lived in London, this was actually a square I'd never been into. It's slightly out of the way. It's a bit mysterious. You can't walk all the way around it because it's got Coram's Fields on one side, which you're only allowed into if you have a child with you. And the garden is very, you know, the hedges are high. You can't quite see in. You're not allowed to go inside. And so I was just very intrigued by this place, which did have this quite sort of intriguing atmosphere. And I did know also that Virginia Woolf had lived there right at the end of her life. So sort of standing there, you know, you can see both houses at once, Woolf's and HD's, although Woolf's house is no longer visible because it was bombed so badly during the war that it's now been rebuilt, whereas HD's house right at the end actually still stands. So it was this odd sort of confluence of history and the present. And it sort of set my mind wandering, and I did a little bit of research and realized that several other really fascinating women had lived in this very same square in the same period between the world wars. And that just set me wondering, you know, why was that? Was it a coincidence, or was there something more to it? Was there, you know, something about this place that had brought these women there? And, you know, what were their lives like there? And how had the square enabled the amazing, fascinating work that they'd all done? And so that set me off on 5 years of research across the world, really, into this small square of London.
I love Mecklenburg Square. And I was so pleased when I saw that someone had written about it, because it's a very short walk from the Charles Dickens Museum. So yes. I know it well. And it's a beautiful square. And as you said, it kind of looks like you've stepped back in time, really, doesn't it? Because it's still there. I mean, it's obviously been modernised, as it's had to be since the wars. But you feel, despite the bustle nearby, just as you said, Gray's Inn Road, very close by, and yet there is an atmosphere, isn't there? Did you feel that? Did you spend a lot of time walking around, imagining these women's lives, being in the square, looking up? Did people think you were that kind of weirdo who was obsessed with that?
Yeah, I mean, I didn't go too far out of my way to wander through with sort of searching for inspiration. But whenever I passed, you know, which often I did, it was always interesting to go in and, you know, and see what you could see in the windows. And, you know, there's often people coming in and out of the houses. I managed to go into one or two. I went into one that was for sale for many millions of pounds while I was working on the book. And, you know, a lot of the furnishings are still pretty much as they were. I mean, I was always trying hard to recreate the atmosphere of being inside one of those houses. And whenever anyone that I found had written, you know, a contemporary account of being inside, I was always very, very interested to find one. I mean, HD and Dorothy Sayers lived in the very same room. It was a boarding house at that point. So there were several flats all. And in fact, they had the very same landlady, I realized, because they both mentioned her quite often in their letters. She was clearly quite an eccentric who prided herself on renting rooms to single women, or sort of women in relationships she deemed sort of unconventional. And she was, in fact, HD, it sort of shows the different feelings I think that they both had about living there. HD, whose marriage was in some turmoil at that point, her husband was having an affair with a woman who lived upstairs in the very same building. HD was, I think, felt very under siege in that house, you know, bombs coming from outside, chaos within. I think she felt very watched by the other people in the house. And there was a system where whenever there was an air raid, everyone in the building should gather in the basement. And she absolutely hated those sort of forced tea parties, and said she'd rather die in her room than go downstairs with the landlady. So she was felt very suspicious of her. Whereas Dorothy Sayers, 3 years later, who had arrived sort of fresh-faced in London, excited about the future, found the landlady very, very helpful and sort of enjoyed having a kind of business-like relationship with her, and wrote back that, you know, her landlady had let her off the rent for a month and had lent her a Botticelli print to hang in her bedroom and so on. So I loved finding that sort of detail about their kind of daily lives in these houses.
And perhaps indicative of both of their emotional states at the time.
Yeah, definitely.
The kind of barometer of the landlady, that HD was obviously finding life extremely difficult. And as you said, Dorothy L. Sayers was full of excitement about her future. So there are five women in here. So Dorothy L. Sayers, Virginia Woolf, H.D. or Hilda Doolittle, Jane Ellen Harrison, and Eileen Power. Now, most people listening to this have probably heard of Sayers and Woolf. Do you want to give us, let's start with, let's have a little potted biography of each one. So for those who may not know, could you tell us who Dorothy L. Sayers was?
Well, Dorothy Sayers is the creator of Lord Peter Wimsey. She's one of the great golden age detective novelists. There's a very active Dorothy Sayers Society for anyone who is a fan. And I mean, at the time that, I suppose an interesting thing about the book was writing about each of them at a different time in their lives, you know, whenever they happened to live in Mecklenburg Square. And so Dorothy Sayers moved in straight after university. She was one of the first women to graduate from Oxford in 1920. And she arrived in London kind of determined to be a writer, but unsure quite how she was going to do it. So she was kind of cobbling together a living from freelance teaching work, translation work, and all the while was writing away on a detective novel with no expectation. Well, she had high ambitions, but obviously no guarantees that this would be successful. And it was hard to sort of keep in mind while I was writing about her at this time that, you know, without hindsight, you know, it could have all turned out very differently. And she, just after she left the square, she managed to find a publisher who took on this book and Whose Body, which begins with a body found in a bathtub and proceeds in ingenious ways.
It's a great novel. Were you a fan of hers beforehand? Are you a fan of detective fiction? Did you like Dorothy L. Sayers' works, or have you discovered
I don't think I particularly knew her work before this, actually, but I absolutely love it. And you know, I read her work in kind of chronological order from Whose Body, and she really kind of came into her style, I think. So about 5 years later, she changed things up a little bit and introduced a new character, Harriet Vane, who's the sort of foil to her main detective, Lord Peter Wimsey, who seems in many ways to be rather based on Sayers herself. And Harriet lives in a small flat in Mecklenburg Square.
I'm sure that was very autobiographical, wasn't it, writing in that way?
Yes, but I think she used it to show, you know, independence. Yeah. That's where you would live if you were an independent.
And it's a really intriguing thing. So tell us what happened to Dorothy L. Sayers. She went on to become a very famous crime author, a very erudite crime author. What else happened?
I mean, she's a wide-ranging kind of intellectual. She was a translator of Dante. She wrote a lot of particularly sort of religious drama and a lot of a great collection of essays. Essays called things like Why Work and Are Women Human? And I guess her best novel is Gaudy Night, which is set in Oxford. It's a sort of detective novel that goes so far beyond what she had come to see as the somewhat formulaic sort of constraints of the genre that she felt were, by this point, she sort of had started to feel were holding her back from writing the kind of novels of ideas that she wanted to write. But she found she was too attached to her hero to just kill him off as she had planned to do. And that's where her character of Harriet Vane really kind of came into her own. And Gaudy Night is, you know, an amazing book on all levels. You know, the plot, the writing are just brilliant. But also, it's a question. The question at its heart, I think, is how a woman, as she puts it, cursed with both heart and brains, can find kind of intellectual fulfillment as well as a kind of an emotional, you know, a relationship that will support her. And this, I think is the question that drove Sayers, as well as many of the other women in my book. At the point when she was living in Mecklenburg Square, Sayers was in a very unsatisfactory relationship with someone who didn't think her work would ever amount to anything. And I think she never quite found the kind of ideal relationship that Harriet Vane is seeking, that would give her the kind of room of her own that all of these women were seeking.
So, oh, it's a now tell us about Virginia Woolf. I'm sure most people have heard of her, but just in case there's anyone who hasn't, tell us about her and what her life was like.
Well, Woolf arrived in the square right in 1939. She committed suicide in 1941. So this was the last year of her life, really. And that was, again, a difficult thing to sort of bear in mind whilst writing about her, because in a way, this year was actually incredibly vital. She was working on so many different projects. She was writing a novel between the acts. She was working on a biography of Roger Fry, her old friend. And she was also beginning work on a memoir, which was interesting because I think, in a time of war, she was sort of set to look back over her life, and she thought right back to her childhood. She'd grown up in Kensington, in West London, in a quite sort of restrained kind of upper middle class family. Her parents had died when she was quite young, and she and her siblings had moved together to Bloomsbury and decided that they were going to totally change their lives. They were going to get rid of all the kind of dark Victorian furnishings and paint the walls white and have friends over freely. And they were going to write and paint and make art in all forms that would kind of see in a new kind of modern era. And this was a project that a lot of their friends were working on in different ways, and Woolf mostly through her novels and her essays, and through her publishing house as well, which she and her husband Leonard Woolf ran together from their home, and the kind of workings of the Hogarth Press were a major concern during the year she spent in the square.
Now, what was happening to Virginia Woolf herself while she was living in the square emotionally? Do you think she was already preparing for the end of her life? Do you think she...
No, I don't think so at all. I think she had had a sort of a mental illness kind of ongoing through her life, which she managed in various ways, and had occasional kind of episodes of kind of deep depression. And I think that in March 1941, she had one of these. But I think during the year, it was a very difficult year. Logistically, she was moving between her house in the country and London. And I think finding London more and more sort of pressure, like a pressure cooker. And I think the atmosphere of war was much more apparent in the city compared to in the country, where she said she felt she could sort of squeeze her brain out like a sponge, and sort of that was where she felt she could actually get writing done. And she did find herself kind of buzzing with ideas, though also very distracted by everything around her.
Whenever I look at the Bloomsbury group, when I teach art history, I teach Vanessa Bell and Mark Goethe and people, and I always think how awful it must have been for that generation who had been old enough to be aware of the First World War and fight, or in their case, mostly be conscientious objectors.
Yeah.
Or have another war when they were still young enough to fight, or to have children who were old enough to go and fight and be killed.
Yeah.
The most incredible generation of people. And no wonder Woolf found that so difficult to be during that war.
Yeah, she found the First World War, I think, had been a real trauma for her. And this, you can see it in her novels. I mean, Mrs. Dalloway is one of the main characters, is a kind of shell-shocked veteran wandering around the city, trying to make sense of himself. And it comes through very strongly into The Lighthouse and The Years, which both feature sort of gaps where there's a sort of before and an after, and then a kind of irreparable void in the middle. And Woolf in her personal life was very affected by the war. And I think the prospect of a Second World War, having known what a toll it had taken on her the first time round, she really had to kind of fortify herself, I think. And it was, very difficult.
So tell us about Hilda Doolittle, or HD. When was she living in the square, and what was she doing?
Well, she was born in America. She'd come over to London in about 1912 and had instantly thrown herself into the kind of circle of Imagist poets around Ezra Pound, who she had known, in fact, had been engaged to briefly as a teenager in Philadelphia. And she married another poet called Richard Aldington, and together they were both writing poetry. She was translating from Greek, and they were living in Mecklenburg Square when he was called up to war. She also, like Wolfe, had a horror of war, which I think is really borne out in her translations of choruses from Greek tragedy, which are mostly women kind of bemoaning the kind of strife, the schism that military life brings to their homes and the utter devastation. And I think that's what it felt like for HD. Her husband went to fight. He would come back for kind of weekend leave, which gave her a very strange sensation that, you know, that this might always be the last time she would see him. But simultaneously, he was having this affair with a woman who lived upstairs, which HD was somewhat keen to support. They had a sort of understanding that their relationship would be free and open and not constraining. But in practice, it was much more difficult. And I think this really bleeds through in her poetry of the time, and interestingly in her later writing. I think after HD left the square, she became pregnant by someone who she had only briefly met, who instantly vanished. And so just after the war, she was sort of alone with a new baby, but met a woman, Briar, who kind of swept her up, and they lived together for the rest of their lives in a, you know, very different, but very supportive relationship. And in the 30s, HD found herself experiencing a serious kind of writer's block and went for analysis with Freud in Vienna, who instantly told her that he could see that this period of the First World War was what was causing this block, and that actually she needed to kind of rewind and take herself back to Mecklenburg Square to figure out the causes of the sort of trauma she was experiencing, which produced this fascinating cycle of novels. She had begun writing a kind of autobiographical novel while she was living in the square, but had set it aside. And in the subsequent years, she had drafted a few different versions of the same story, often kind of transposing the action to different time periods, or sort of changing the emphasis. Different characters became more or less important in different versions. And at Freud's encouragement, she went back to the first novel and finished it. And it was published in 1960, so right at the end of her life and a long time after the events. So for a biographer, it's both fascinating and very complicated to be faced with four or five novels which all tell the same story, all very clearly, you know, rooted in autobiography. But, you know, the fallibility of memory and the... you know, and the whims of fiction are obviously at play. So it's impossible to sort through and, you know, totally sift truth from fiction. But I think sort of on a psychological level, the kind of inner delving that HD was doing in her later life back to this period was really kind of fertile ground.
Well, now tell us who Jane Ellen Harrison was.
Jane Harrison is the oldest in the book. She, unlike most of my other women, lived there earlier on in their careers, but she arrived in her 70s. She'd had a long and rocky road to academic success. She was one of the first women to study at Cambridge in one of the women's colleges. And after she left university, had hoped to make a career as a classicist, but was constantly rejected for jobs and forced to pursue a career outside the academy, which she did pretty well. She lectured all around the country. She traveled a lot to archaeological digs that were happening around sort of Turkey and the Middle East, which were very pioneering, and a lot of new discoveries were being made very quickly, and she was right on the scene. And so without the sort of stability of an academic post, she created these really kind of pioneering works of ancient history, totally upending expectations of ancient religion, and arguing that that the kind of religious cults that were well known from Greek epic and tragedy were actually dated back much, much further to matriarchal cults that had been subsequently erased, and the women goddesses who were originally worshipped in sort of communities of women had over time been kind of eroded and replaced by male gods. And as women were kind of pushed out of kind of civic life. So a very kind of radical thesis, which really spoke to people like Wolf, actually, and the kind of a younger generation of, you know, of feminists and writers who were interested in this total reevaluation of the ancient past. She didn't get a job until she was in her 50s, when she was finally invited back to teach at Newnham Women's College, which finally gave her the kind of academic framework where she could have time to really finish her books and publish them and sort of made her name. But she left Cambridge in 1922, kind of fed up with the sort of masculine nature of the institution. And she left with one of her students, Hope Merlies, who was a poet who knew, in fact, her poem Paris was published by the Hogarth Press by Virginia Woolf. And the two of them lived together briefly in Paris and then in Bloomsbury. At this point, Jane Harrison was had become fascinated by Russian and was busy translating from Russian and also working on a memoir too.
Wonderful. And the last of the five is Eileen Power, who probably most people haven't heard of before. Do you want to tell us a little bit about her?
Eileen Power was one of my biggest kind of discoveries, because I didn't know about her before writing the book. And she's someone who was involved in so many different things, but a lot of her work hasn't really survived because it was in the kind of ephemeral form of teaching. She was a very inspiring teacher. And she was an economic historian. Her first book, Medieval People, kind of put the spotlight on working class, kind of ordinary people, and suggested that their lives were of just as much, if not more, interest to historians than, you know, than the public lives of, you know, of rulers and kings and so on. And that was, so it was really one of the first works of social history and caused quite a sensation when it was published. And over the 1930s, she was very involved in the work of the League of Nations. She was absolutely passionate about the idea of world history, that, you know, with the sort of onslaught of a Second World War looming, she believed that the only way that children would kind of learn, you know, that the only way to ensure a peaceful future would be for children to see other countries as, you know, not as enemies, but as, you know, as allies and as friends, and to understand histories and things in common. So she, at the LSE where she taught international history, and she, with her sister, did a really sort of pioneering series of radio broadcasts that aimed at children on world history. So she's an amazing sort of confluence of internationalism and pacifism and feminism, and also a real character. It was a little difficult to sort of bring out her personality because many of her personal papers have been destroyed, but she was very kind of stylish. She, there are rumors that she flew to Paris whenever she had an article published to buy a new outfit.
I love that.
She often, like Harrison, she often wasn't taken seriously in the male world of academia because she was a woman, because she was sort of interested in fashion and, you know, was, you know, had a sense of humor. But she was confident, and probably more confident than Harrison, actually, in her academic credentials, and relished proving people wrong if they ever underestimated her.
And with her beliefs about war, it feels like we need her today, really, to try and adjust generation. So what, for you, came out of connecting these five women?
I think it was setting their lives alongside each other made me read each of them in a different way. And I guess I was always looking to answer this question of what had brought them there and, you know, what they were looking for and what they had achieved in Mecklenburg Square. And I think what helped me to think this through was Wolf's essay, A Room of One's Own, where she argues that, in order to write, women need both the physical space that will offer them, you know, quiet, undisturbed sort of freedom, but also a sort of, the room becomes a kind of metaphor for, you know, a place in society that will, you know, take them seriously, that will, allow the conditions for them to write. And I think each of them were trying to forge that in their own ways and with kind of varying degrees of success. I think it was, in a way, they were all challenging the same scripts of how a woman's life should be led, and were kind of forging their own kind of responses to the expectations that surrounded them. And they were all, you know, in their works, often they were challenging kind of official narratives of history. And in their lives, they were seeking the conditions under which they could write. And I found it fascinating to kind of compare them and to kind of set them in conversation in a way across the years to see how they were all coping with the same struggles as each other and, you know, as people do even now.
I found that fascinating. And I found that not only with Wolf, but that Wolf's phrase, A Room of One's Own, just kept coming back to me in comparison with all of them. And I think that's something you bring across very well. And that's this kind of haven that Mecklenburg Square is. I feel next time I walk around there, I'm going to feel all this creative energy from these extraordinary people who lived and worked there. I also kind of wonder whether the landlady needs her own biography now. How fascinating was that, that house that she lived in. Did you discover anything unexpected when you were doing your research?
Yes, I discovered a lot of unexpected things. I'm trying to think. I suppose Eileen Power was the one that I had perhaps known least about. And as I said, because a lot of her papers were had been destroyed after she died by her sisters, I hadn't expected to be able to draw out the texture of her relationship in quite so much detail until right at the end of my research. I managed to meet the son of her husband. She married quite near the end of her life, and she died very suddenly in 1940. And her husband had gone on to remarry and have two sons, and he very kindly gave me some letters between Power and his father, which had been written during the war. When the Second World War hit, Power was teaching at the LSE, and her husband was working in the war ministry and was very suddenly sent off on a kind of diplomatic mission to Moscow. And Power was left in London. I don't think she even said goodbye to him, and had no idea if she would see him again. And his journey home was cut off because of the Dunkirk invasion. So he had to take a sort of round trip. I think he came back via South Africa. And meanwhile, she wrote him these letters because she didn't know if she would be alive by the time he got back, if he got back, and wrote these letters sort of reflecting back on her life and on their life together, which are incredibly moving to read, and also filled in a lot of sort of detail that I hadn't been able to get from elsewhere. And it showed her utter conviction of the importance of her work. She said, you need to finish my my book if I don't manage to finish it and make sure it's published. But also reflected on, you know, on how enabling their relationship had been to her writing life and the happiness that it had given her, which was, yeah, very sort of powerful to read right at the end of a process of having, you know, read as everything I thought I was going to be able to read about her.
Did you contact, were you in contact with other family members of the other women in your book as well? Did you get help from any of them?
No, I don't think I did.
Just wondering how Eileen's and perhaps other people's families received your book. Have you heard any feedback from the stepson who gave you so much help?
Yes, no, I definitely have heard a lot from him. The others, I mean, many of these women didn't have children, interestingly. Yeah. I mean, Dorothy Sayers did have a child in difficult circumstances, rather eerily similar to HD, actually. She had just left Mecklenburg Square and, in fact, had broken off the relationship with the person she was with while she was in the square, mainly on the grounds that he had said he didn't want to have children. And then she'd had a very short-term relationship with someone who, as soon as she found she was pregnant, vanished. And in fact, then it turned out he had a wife and another child sort of down the road. And Sayers, whose family was quite religious and had had a very sort of a vicarage upbringing, I think was plunged into a real kind of quandary and decided not to tell anyone about her pregnancy. She was working at that point at an advertising firm, which produced her excellent novel Murder Must Advertise. And she gave birth to the baby in secret. She took a few weeks off work. No one seems to have noticed. And she sent the baby to a cousin of hers who made a living fostering children, who brought him up. And he did keep in touch with Sayers and learned at some point, probably much later than he had actually already figured it out, that she was his mother. But their relationship was always sort of somewhat distant.
Yeah.
And Jane Harrison and Wolfe didn't have children.
So where did you begin with your research? When you got the idea, presumably you came up with a proposal for a book. Mm-hmm. When it was commissioned, what did you start doing? Did you already know where you needed to go for research, or did you suddenly think, help, how am I going to find it?
I think I probably started with the square itself. I spent a lot of time in the Camden local history library, trying to work out what, you know, what the significance of the square would have been, what it would have meant to live there at the time, you know, what the sort of social class positions of people who could have lived there was. And actually it was really fascinating to learn really about the history of London and the kind of building crisis which actually enabled this situation, because Bloomsbury was laid out originally as a very kind of upper middle class suburb by the Duke of Bedford, who had this vision for a kind of grand estate on his land with with elegant squares of sort of enormous houses designed very much for a nuclear family, with a mews at the back for to keep carriages and so on. And this building project began and ran into all kinds of difficulties and ended up lasting kind of decades and centuries. And by the time the houses began to be ready to live in, fashions had changed. And actually any family who could have afforded to buy one of these houses wanted to live in West London, which was much more kind of stylish. And so these mansions languished empty until eventually the Duke allowed them to be divided up into flats. And this was a time when, when the way of living was changing, and a lot of, women were coming through universities and were entering the workforce and actually didn't want to move straight from a family to a marital home, but wanted to live on their own or with a friend. And so at this point, these boarding houses in Mecklenburg Square was one of the squares that eventually was allowed to have flats. And so you can trace, in newspaper adverts, the way that they start to advertise, it's often aimed at, you know, at single kind of working ladies. And so it was this real kind of social phenomenon based on this sort of architectural quirk that actually enabled, sort of created Bloomsbury as this quarter. And it was close to the railway stations and to the universities. So it was a very international area, a lot of publishing houses kind of set up. And of course, there was the British Museum, which at that point, you know, was the British Library with its reading room, where anyone could get a ticket. And so I went at one point to the British Museum archive and found the applications for a reading card of each of my subjects.
I love that tangibility when you're researching somebody and you come across something so pertinent to them. And to someone who's not researching it or who isn't a historian, it's just nothing. But when it's your field, it's just the most amazing feeling, isn't it?
Yeah.
So tell us what you're working on now, because I know you're researching a new project and it sounds fascinating. Do you want to tell us a little bit about it?
Yeah, I'm currently working on a book about the American writer Gertrude Stein. It's a kind of biography told through her afterlife. Stein was created a real kind of legend around herself in her lifetime. She became very famous in 1933 after the publication of her autobiography, which was written in the voice of her adoring partner, Alice B. Toklas. But Stein was frustrated because she'd actually written the autobiography with a kind of ulterior motive to draw attention back to her earlier work, her very avant-garde experimental kind of poetry, which she felt was not getting the acclaim that it deserved. She believed that, you know, that her work was incredibly important and deserved a readership. But unfortunately, she found it very hard to find publishers. And when she did, often her work was mocked. And so she'd sort of become famous almost for the wrong reasons, and was determined to set things up so that after she died, her unpublished work would be published and she would find in the future the readership she felt she'd sort of been deprived of in her lifetime. So I'm kind of picking up the story at her death and exploring how her partner, Alice B. Toklas, acted as a kind of gatekeeper to her estate in the 20 years that she lived after Stein's death, during which time Stein's archive was kind of collected and biographers started to come and interview Toklas about her life with Stein and kind of discovered all sorts of new things about Stein that changed the narrative from her autobiography.
Tell us about your writing process. I mean, how long did it take you to research Squirrel Haunting before you started writing? And then do you kind of sit down for 15 hours a day, or do you only write in the morning?
I was probably working on Squirrel Haunting for 5 years. I mean, writing about five women obviously means that you have five times the amount of material available. And even when I'm only writing about, you know, a small part of their life, you know, I needed to know what happened before and after. And in so many cases, you know, the short time in Mecklenburg Square actually, you know, affected the rest of their lives. Stephanie Worth Sayers and NHD saw them writing about it much later. So there was a certain amount of traveling. You know, each of them has their own archives around the UK and around America. I couldn't really know what the whole book would look like, I think, until I had knew each of them well enough to see the connections. I think it wasn't until I looked at Eileen Power and got so interested in her internationalism, for instance, that I realized how important internationalism was to Wolfe, say, who was writing between the acts, you know, at a time of war, and thinking back to her book Three Guineas and very much thinking about, you know, peace and the future of Europe and her own place in it. And then I realized how, you know, how closely that connected to Jane Harrison's interest in Russian as well. And thinking about Jane Harrison's classical work made me think of HD's Greek tragedy translations in a very different way, and seeing them as part of the same project, really. So it took a long time to, you know, to work out what I wanted to say about each of them individually, and then to for that to kind of shed light on and change the way I was looking at each one. So a long but very rewarding process of research and writing.
Well, thank you so much for coming on today. It's been really fascinating to hear about this, and I'm really looking forward to your next book as well. I would thoroughly recommend buying Square Haunting. Subtitle, as I said, Five Women, Freedom and London Between the Wars by Francesca Wade. And it is a really, it's a well-written, easy-to-read book. It's fascinating. And it just gives such an interesting perspective of a slice of London life in through a fascinating lens, where you just take one small area. And I'm really looking forward to your next one. So good luck with it. Can you please bear with me while I just tell everybody what is coming up next on Gold
Star? Yeah, I want to know.
So tomorrow we have our book of the month. For those of you who come along regularly, you know that the last Friday of the month, we always do like a kind of regular book club. We read a book together and then discuss it. If you haven't read it, you're still welcome to come along. I can't guarantee there'll be no spoilers. This month, we are back on contemporary works, and it's the most beautiful book. I absolutely adored reading this book. It's The Whalebone Theatre by Joanna Quinn. It's one of those books that you just can't put down when you're reading it. It's a fantastic novel, beautifully written, but very, very easy to read. And I've just been totally caught up in the world of the characters. In fact, you know, I was one of those ones that I was eking out because I didn't want to end it because it was so good. And then I'm back on nonfiction next week, back on Thursday, with Wendy Moore, who is the author of Endell Street, The Women Who Ran Britain's Trailblazing Military Hospital. It was a BBC Radio 4 book of the week. And it's such an interesting idea, a little bit like Francesca's idea, actually, looking through one lens and telling a story of women at the time. It tells the story of two pioneering women doctors, Louisa Garrett Anderson and Flora Murray, who set up and ran a major military hospital in London during the First World War. And it was, of course, in Endell Street in Covent Garden. For those of you who know London, that name will be obvious. And then a very different type of nonfiction book on Friday next week, the 3rd of November, I shall be talking to author Shelley Powers, who told her mother when she was 7 years old, growing up in the north of England, that she was going to marry Elvis Presley when she grew up. She didn't marry him, but she's written a book about him. And she lived in Vegas. She was actually married to an Elvis tribute artist for some years. And she became involved with Elvis International, which is the kind of huge Elvis fan club, as it were. And one of her roles was to interview Elvis's friends and associates. Well, some of those are no longer alive, but she did a series of fascinating interviews, and she's written a book called Elvis Remembered. It's just coming out in the UK next week, and it's already doing very well in America. And she's going to come and talk to us about those intimates of Elvis's circle and what they told her. And for those, anyone who's a fan of Elvis, come along. I think she'll outfan you. She's a kind of super fan, but it'll be great to hear your own stories of Elvis as well. And then the following week, I'm back on Tuesday with PPG. I'm going to be interviewing Mark Woods. He's a Paralympian swimmer. He's also just an amazing person, really fascinating. And just, I think you'll love his stories. He had to have part of one of his legs amputated through teenage cancer and has gone on to become the most extraordinary sportsman commentator. If you've ever watched the Paralympics on the BBC, you'll have seen Mark on there. Also a really lovely guy. And he's going to come on and talk about his career and his motivational speaking as well. And then Humphrey will be back for book club later that week. And he will be talking on the 9th of November to J.R. Seeger, who is a retired senior intelligence service officer who was with the CIA for more than 20 years. And guess what? He's now writing books. His latest book he's going to be talking about is Mike 4. And then he's back again on Friday, the 10th of November, with Alex Gurlis. He's an author and expert on espionage. He worked as a BBC journalist from the 1980s to 2011 and was head of BBC training for many years. He writes about Second World War thrillers set in the Second World War. So we've got a lot of interesting things coming up for you. And please do come along to the Whalebone Theatre Book of the Month tomorrow. I'm longing to chat about it. It's the most gorgeous book. Come along and talk to me about it. And if you haven't read it yet, come and be inspired. Thank you, Francesca, and good luck your event in Boston tonight.
I know. Thank you.
Better with us tonight. And we look forward to hearing more from you in the future.
Thank you. Very nice to talk to you and meet you all.
Take care, everybody. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to this Goldster podcast, where we aim to bring you great interviews to expand your world and to keep you curious. Please look us up at www.goldster.co.uk. That's Goldster spelt G-O-L-D-S-T-E-R. And don't forget to subscribe to the podcast.